wherever you may be around the world, and thank you for joining us once again on truth2u.org. That's truth number two, letter u.org. It is season two of Torah Pearls. I'm Jono, and joining me in the virtual Truth to You studio all the way from Ireland is Jason of spiritualbabies.net.
Good morning, everyone.
I was running out of air. I thought, should I take a breath right there, or should I just squeeze out the .net?
Squeeze it out.
There it is. And in Jakarta, Indonesia, the author of the recently released Let's Get Biblical, Why Doesn't Judaism Accept the Christian Messiah, Volumes 1 and 2. You can get a copy from his website, outreachjudaism.org. That's outreachjudaism.org. Welcome back to the program, Rabbi Tobias Singer.
Why are you screaming so much? I'm kidding. It's a pleasure to be back. <It's good. laughs> Why is this bit so excited?
I am excited. It's so exciting. And now, by the way, we're always plugging your book. And just a reminder, everyone, Let's Get Biblical. Why Doesn't Judaism Accept the Christian Messiah, Volumes 1 and 2? Highly recommend it. Get it from outreachjudaism.org. Always plugging that one, and so we should be. But I don't think we've ever mentioned Jason's book. Did you know that Jason wrote a book?
I know what Jason never mentioned it.
No one knows about this book. He wrote a book. It took him years and years to write. It's an awesome book. Jason, quickly, just tell us what it's called.
It's called Paul Quoting Jesus.
Paul Quoting Jesus. That's what it is. It's Paul Quoting Jesus.
I studied for about 3 years all the Pauline manuscripts, and I curated all of this material, and I put it down into a book with a personal message. And put it at the low price of whatever Amazon's charging for the minimum price. Now it changes every week.
I think it's 99 cents.
Oh, look at that, 99 cents for your salvation, cheap. And it's on Amazon.
It's on Amazon. You know what? I left a review. I left a review on Tobias' book last week. I'm so proud of myself. But maybe I should do that for your book. I haven't done that yet. Now that I've done it once, I have to do it. So people can get it on Amazon. Can you get a hard cover, like a nice?
Wait, what is this about? About Jesus quoting Paul? Is that
no? Paul quoting Jesus.
What intrigues me? What is that?
Well, I don't want to give it away for free. These are secrets. I don't give
the
secrets.
Can't be on one paragraph. I mean, you could do like a synopsis, like just a. Okay, we're going off course. This is like a two-page book now. So you could what do you put on the inside of the cover? You got to put something in there, right?
It's 99 cents. Is a great picture of smart Tobias is.
99 cents. I'm going to put a link on this post. People can go to Amazon and buy the book. Now you can't get a. You're telling me you can't get a hardcover?
It's only available in e-format.
It's available in e-format. So the moment that you purchase it, you have it. Is that the way it works?
That's exactly it. And you can put it on all your mobile devices. It won't take up much space.
It won't take up too much space. And you can spend the whole week reading it. Believe me, people, you'll be glued to it like I was. You won't be able to put it down until you finish the whole entire book. And I would love to hear your comments in this post after you've read it. Love to hear your thoughts. In fact, people, you should definitely leave a review on Amazon, as I did.
That's interesting.
How's that?
That's great.
There we go. Taking to it, Tobia.
I'm actually doing that. Like, as we're speaking, I mean, not as we're speaking, but I just started uploading everything for Kindle. The two of them. I'm not kidding. It just happened to work that way.
Now, while you're doing that, comments. So, g'day to Fred. Fred said, hi, y'all from Southeast Texas. He said, I really enjoyed the banter and top-notch Torah Pearls. Thanks, Fred. He said, I work all day driving local route delivery and pass the time, he says, 6 to 8 hours a day listening to various podcasts, learning all I can about the Bible. That's great, Fred. Thanks for writing in and letting us know. Ben Afra. Ben said, Truth to You is great. I always listen to the show on the bus or when I'm working out. Well, that's what I do too, Ben, when I'm working. In fact, I'm working out right now. I, when I'm recording, I'm working out.
That's right.
And so is Jason. Jason's on his...
I'm on my treadmill right now.
You're on the treadmill, and believe it or not, as we speak, Tobia is scuba diving. And so we like to stay active as well. And now the comments. We are in Vayeshev. That's where we are, Vayeshev. Genesis chapter 37, verse 1 to chapter 40, verse 23. And it begins like this. Now Jacob dwelt in the land where his father was a stranger, in the land of Canaan. This is the history of Jacob. Joseph, being 17 years old, was feeding the flock with his brothers, and The lad was with the sons of Bilhah and the sons of Zilpah, his father's wives, and Joseph brought a bad report of them to his father. Now Israel loved Joseph more than all his children because he was the son of his old age. Also, he made him a tunic of many colors. There's the coat of many colors. But when his brothers saw that their father loved him more than all his brothers, they hated him and could not speak peaceably to him. Now Joseph had a dream, and he told it to his brothers, and they hated him even more. And so they said to him, and so he said to them, rather, please hear this dream which I have dreamt. There we were binding sheaves in the field, and behold, my sheep arose and stood upright, and indeed your sheaves all stood around and bowed down to mine. And his brothers said to him, shall you indeed reign over us, or shall you indeed have dominion over us? And so they hated him even more for his dreams and for his words. Then he dreamed still another dream and told it to his brothers and said, look, I've dreamed another dream, and this time the sun, the moon, and 11 stars bowed down to me. And so he told it to his father and to his brothers, and his father rebuked him and said, what is this dream that you have dreamed? Shall your mother and I and all your brothers indeed come and bow down to the earth before you? And his brothers envied him, but his father kept the matter in mind. Tobia.
Yeah, the opening passage here is told us, these are the Chronicles of Jacob. What's coming into view in this chapter is we're no longer dealing with the situation of Abraham's children, who is going to be chosen and who is not going to be a part of the people of Israel. One of the themes that we talked about in, as the book of Genesis unfolded before our eyes is that here we're forming the royal family. That's what the book of Genesis is devoted to. Well, now Jacob, all of Jacob's children, all of his 12 sons, and they're going to form the nation of Israel, the people of Israel, the children of Israel, quite literally. But the question is, who would lead this nation? Which tribe would have a leadership position? Ordinarily, one would say that the firstborn would lead the nation, which would be Reuben. But we've already learned that Reuben was disqualified. He showed poor judgment, and we're going to see that once again in the notion that Reuben is going to try, he's going to, we'll talk about that in a moment, but he's going to fail at the position of leadership. So by default, notice how strange this is. It says, these are the toldos of Jacob, and then it just says Joseph is 17 years old. Where's everybody else? Now, one point should be mentioned here. At about this moment, Leah dies, at about right here. So what we have here is we have Jacob, we have the two wives, who now we're going to see be elevated to be called wives. Notice that, you'll notice here, first time Bilhah and Zilpah are called his father's wives. They're no longer called maidservants, because now both Rachel and Leah have passed away right here at this juncture in history. Now, Jacob is everybody is looking at these dreams, but the second dream is the one that's related over to Jacob, because the second dream, the first dream, is the sheaves that are standing, and those are the 11 that bow down to him. Mm. So Jacob and his wife are not included in this. But in the second dream, Jacob is included in this, and Jacob is perplexed by this because he says, your father and your mother will also bow to you. Now, what's strange to what Jacob has in mind is your mother is dead. That's not possible. How could this dream be in any way fortuitous of your destiny of being the leader? Every person observing, listening carefully to these dreams is deeply bothered by it in every way. Contrast this to the most well-known dream, which we discussed in great depth. And the reason we spent a lot of time discussing the great dream of Jacob that he has in the place of God and the sleep of the ladder connecting heaven and earth. I mean, it's all connected and God is on top of the ladder. That's what's critical. This dream to the brothers seems to contradict all of that. You notice that the first dream, there is nothing is about the land, is about sheaves of wheat standing up. Mm-hmm. There's no connection to the sky there. The second dream is all in the heavens. It's all celestial, no connection to the ground. So these two dreams, there's a disconnect here, which the brothers are observing, that's deeply problematic. One other point is Jews were not the patriarchs. They were not farmers. They were shepherds. The land of Israel was not a land that was given to produce agriculture. Now it is. Today, Israel is exporting flowers and fruits all over the world. But that wasn't the case 100 years ago. There's a special blessing now because the Jews are there. That's why if you wanted to be a farmer, it's a very difficult place to do that in the land of Israel. It's all rocky and so on.
It's very rocky, yeah.
Yeah, but Egypt was the place. Egypt was the place where food came from. As Herodotus said, it's because, you know, there was that jewel of the Nile that Egypt had. Egypt was the foundation, was the center of everything that was the earth. It did not rely on rain. The land of Israel, you need that rain during the winter or else you would starve. Egypt never needed rain. Food was always available. It had the Nile. The Nile always ran, and the land always was very bountiful. That's where the farming was. The land. So therefore, they're observing the spectacle. They're shocked by it, and their jealousy by seeing that Jacob had loved Yosef so deeply, but also now had converted into also a deep hatred for him, because they were saying, we're going to bow down to you, meaning you think with this kind of attitude, with this kind of view of how our 12 tribes be formed, meaning surrounding you, that can't be, because your dreams, your vision is completely at odds, is not even connected to the land of Israel. It's a completely different connection. That's what we're seeing here, is there's a distress, there's a great hatred. Nothing at this point, Jacob, nothing Joseph could have possibly said would have been satisfying to the brothers, because as scripture tells us, anything that he said, they would just see it. They couldn't even have a conversation with him that was peaceful. They couldn't, because their hatred for him was so deep and so great.
And it's mentioned, I mean, four times, you know, in the verse, what is it, verse 4, I think it says, they hated him. Verse 5, they hated him even more. Verse 8, they hated him even more. And then in verse 11, his brothers envied him. Jason.
Yeah, I just wanted to pull up a couple of things. Firstly, Toby there mentioned that Leah had died, and that Bilhah and Zilpah are being called in as mothers now. There's a couple of interesting things there that spark for me. One, Laban made Jacob promise not to take any wives while he was married to his daughters. So he kind of, the text at least keeps that to be true. And there's another cool thing that in Egypt, there are a series of tombs that date back to the patriarchal age where they show Semitic chiefs, and the chiefs of the tribe wore these very ornate coats of many colors. And it was a picture of their status in the tribe. So I have to wonder, although Joseph, to be fair, is kind of, he's not very cultured in how to deal with other people. Maybe it wasn't the best idea to go around saying, you know,
yeah, that's right. It doesn't seem like it was the best idea to go to the brothers who hated him and say, oh, well, what do you think of this dream? Hey, I mean, and maybe it wasn't delivered in such a way.
Yeah, he didn't deliver it very well. Then he was wearing this fantastic coat, which, even if not the norm within his tribe, we have to remember that they're sojourning in a foreign land. Mm-hmm. And it might well be that they're looking at people who, the leader of those tribes, are wearing coats that are very similar to this one that Joseph's just got. I just wanted to ask Toby a little bit about the very next passage where Jacob says, what is this dream that you have dreamed? Shall I and your mother and your brethren bow down now? But his mother's dead. Is this a fair translation, or does it say mothers, or is he literally speaking about the dead mother?
Yes, quite literally. Let's go to the Hebrew here. Vayigar by Aviv, his father was outraged, Vayomer lo, and he said to him, Mo hachalom hazeh asher chalamta, what is this dream that you dreamed? Havo novo ani v'imcha v'achecha l'shtach v'is loch l'arza, l'cha l'arza, do you really believe that I and your mother and your brothers will bow down to you down to the ground? So this really shocked him. Every aspect of this, and everybody here doesn't have a grasp exactly on what's going on, but fate is unfolding right now. People are, you hinted to this earlier, people are going to act a little impetuously, quickly. Joseph is going to act quickly. Jacob is not going to our sages talk about this, is did not was should have been more careful in illustrating his favoritism towards Joseph. And in fact, in Jewish law, one is if one buys a gift for one child, one should make sure to buy a gift for another child. This may seem superficial, but from everybody in here, in this has a cheshbon, which means has an accounting of what's going on. They don't quite get all of it here, but people, and this is going to continue, are going to act very quickly with their anger. We're going to see that just right before us. Going to move. They're not going to take their time to think through the events that are unfolding. And as a result, errors are going to be made. But of course, the big picture is that God is controlling everything from behind the scenes so that prophecy can unfold before our eyes. So Jacob is connected to Egypt. They see that in his dream because, again, there are no farmers among, there are no farmers in King David, in Saul. All those are, Saul was an herder of donkeys. David of sheep, Abraham, Isaac, David, they all were herds. It was, this is not a place where people had farms. So when you think about a place that had very high level of agriculture, that's Egypt. That, and Egypt, of course, is the place, is that place of vanity, is that place of this world, not at all connected to God. The people of Egypt don't even need to pray for rain. They don't need the rain because they, after all, have the Nile. So they're going, how could this, right, how could, what is Joseph doing in agriculture? And why isn't Joseph, like Dad did, why isn't Joseph, look at the first dream and the second dream, earth, heaven, but there's no connection. There's they're not connected to each other. So everything about what's happening here is moving in a direction that people don't like. And of course, because they already were jealous of him and they hated him, the text says that actually nothing that he would express would be taken kindly.
No. And so it was that they were out shepherding, and Jacob said to Joseph, look, go and check on your brothers and bring back word for me. And so he sets out to go and find them. And they're some distance away too. And when he came close, and this is verse 18, they saw him from afar off. And even before he came near them, the brothers conspired against him to kill him. And I guess maybe they thought, you know, we're a fair distance away. We're fairly remote here. We could get away with something like this.
Yeah,
and they said to one another, look, the dreamer is coming. Come, therefore, let us kill him and cast him into a pit. And we'll just say, you know, that the wild beast has devoured him. And then we'll see what will become of his dreams. But Reuben, now does Reuben vindicate himself somewhat here? He copped a bit of trouble in the previous chapters. But it says Reuben heard it and he delivered him out of their hands and said, let's not kill him. Come on, right, fellas.
So what's going to happen is we're going to see a series of plans. We're going to see plan number one. Plan number one. Now, there's a point here. The brothers have become totally disconnected from him. That means the kinship is already shattered. There is a passage we went over, and that is that on his way, Joseph really doesn't know where to find his brothers. He encounters a man. The text is silent on who this man is, but in Jewish tradition, this is the angel Gabriel. And Joseph is saying, I'm looking for my brothers. And the man says to him where they can find him. But if you notice, the man says, is giving him a hint, and that is, they've gone down to this other place. I mean, they don't consider you brothers anymore. So that has been shattered. What occurs here is the plan number one is kill him. They're very angry, and they're going to kill him. And then we're going to say to our father that Joseph was devoured by a wild beast. Reuven here is doing the right thing, in that he wants to rescue Joseph, and he comes up with a plan that no one else is in on. And the plan is that he's going to, he knows the brothers are too angry, so let's have him throw him in a pit, and then I will rescue him from the pit and give him back to Dad. So this is going to, we're going to encounter a number of plans that are going to come here, that come to be, and actually none of their plans come to fruition. Reuben is going to be horrified in just a moment.
He's obviously somewhere along the line he's separated from the rest of the guys, because it came to pass that when Joseph had come to his brothers, that they stripped Joseph of the tunic of many colors that was on him, and they took him, they cast him into a pit. Pit was empty, there was no water in it, and then they sat down to eat a meal. And they lifted up their eyes and looked, there were a company of Ishmaelites coming from Gilead with their camels bearing spices and balm and all sorts of stuff. And Judah, now Judah said, fellas, what profit is there if we kill our brother and conceal his blood? Come, let us sell him to the Ishmaelites and let not our hand be upon him. For after all, our brother, I mean, he's our flesh. And the brothers listened. And then it says, then Midianite traders passed by. So the brothers pulled Joseph up from and lifted him out of the pit and sold him to the Ishmaelites for 20 shekels of silver.
Yeah.
And so it was. Now, we've got Ishmaelites, and we've got Midianites, and we've got Ishmaelites. But what's going on there?
It's a complex story. It's a very complex story of precisely what happened. We're going, there's a number of anomalies here, and that is, it is a mistake to believe that the brothers sold Joseph. That means they never carried out their plan. What happens is that Joseph is in a pit. That means he's in a place he can't get out of. Reuben has a plan, and that is he's going to come back later and save him. So they're in another area now. They could see from a distance a caravan of the Ishmaelites, B'nai Ishmael. What they don't see is another group, and that is a group of Midianites. What happens then is the Midianites go and they take Joseph out of the pit, and they sell him to the Ishmaelites, who are traders for long, kind of what we would call long haul traders. They were, to Joseph's good grace, they were not carrying disgusting things, but they were. It was really a very good smelling stuff. What happens then is, imagine Reuben's horror that he then comes back to the pit, which means no one is near the pit, and Reuben is certainly not there. And he sees that Joseph is not in there. He knows nothing about the Midianites. Because let's look at this passage carefully. This is the passage that I think people miss, and that's verse 28. Look at verse 28. The people of Midian, if you want to do this, I don't know how your English translation.
So the Midianite traders passed by.
Right. That's the key point there. All right.
Right.
Okay.
So they passed by. So the brothers pulled Joseph up out.
It doesn't say that. This is what the text says. This is how it reads. Vayavru adoshim midyonim. There's the Midianites. Okay. The sochem they were traders, okay? Vayalu es Yosef, and they raised up Joseph min habor.
Ah, okay. Really? Yes. Jason, what have you got in your translation in front of you?
I have, and they drew up and lifted out Joseph out of the pit.
And is the they, when you read that, is the they
the Midianites, because it starts with the Midianites, are the only people in that verse, yeah.
Very interesting.
This is going to resolve a number of problems. That means understanding the series of events that are actually occurring here. That means what are the Midianites doing in the story? That means if in fact the brothers take him out of the pit and sell him to the Ishmaelites,
then why was Reuben surprised? What
are Midianites doing there? Why is Reuben surprised? He's in on it. So have to stop this for a moment. There are big problems here. Why would Reuben was took it upon himself. That means he was a firstborn. It's very clear that Reuben always had good intentions, but he just never was able to carry them out. Even when he trampled his father's bed, there was a thought process going on that was misdirected, but it just didn't come to fruition. Once again, Reuben is biding his time, but the message here is that your time can run out. The brothers are really angry. Well, he's thinking he's going to save Joseph and give him over to father. What are the brothers going to say then? Well, by then, the brothers will have calmed down in their anger. That's his plan. Happens here is why does Reuven shot? If the brothers had in fact delivered Joseph to the Ishmaelim, what's going here? He saw Joseph was not in the pit. By Yikra es begodov, he tore his clothing in mourning. That means he had blown it completely. So now what's happening is no one knows the truth. Everyone believes, this is key, everyone believes that they didn't sell Joseph to the Ishmaelites. They don't know that. They do think he's dead. Reuben is going to have a different response to the other brothers, at least from the text. Reuben is completely shattered because here he had a plan, but he didn't implement it well. It just went awry. of writing. And we're going to see this. I'm going to do something we don't normally do, because as you, the listener, figure out by now, Genesis is so pregnant with everything. As you can imagine, you know, what Jason, Jono, and I are doing here is we're almost doing triage on what to talk about, because every passage here is like exploding, you know, with incredible messages here, and we're restrained. But this is the basic understanding of what's occurring here. Reuven is absolutely shattered with this, but when he comes and tells the brothers then simply are, they are disinterested. They are coming up with a plan, and the plan is, what are they going to tell Dad? Which means following. What people normally think about this passage is that the 10 brothers, Benjamin, who's 8 years younger than Joseph, is not anywhere near this. He's just a baby. He's a kid. But what the 10 brothers do think, that Joseph is dead. I mean, he's gone. They have no idea that he was sold, because the Midianites stood there behind his back, their back. And the only thing is, they're now concocting, we'll call it a white lie. It's really worse than a white lie, because they did initially intend to kill him. Suddenly he's gone. So they have to just explain this to Dad, and they have to actually show him evidence of the death, but they don't think that they're lying about everything, because now everybody is shocked. Reuven is deeply hurt. Now, I want to, for a moment, we have to, in order to completely connect this all and see how this weaves together quite incredibly, is I want to go just, well, this is next week's portion, but actually we see a quick conversation, and this is in Parshas Mikates. Now, what's happening here is a little bit later on, that we're going to have insight into what they're thinking. Genesis 42, and what happens here is, we're not going to talk about the story, because they're saving that for next week. But I want to just look at two passages. The brothers fulfilling prophecy, they are bowing down to Joseph, who they think is essentially the viceroy in charge of all the wealth of Egypt. They don't recognize Joseph, but Joseph recognizes them. Joseph is going to speak harshly to them, which is further going to veil his identity. And there's an interpreter there. What's happening is, in the scene, is you have Joseph, who is sort of the viceroy. He's a member of Egypt's cabinet. He's in charge of all the treasury and so on. You have the 10 brothers who are speaking in Hebrew, right? And there's an interpreter there, because Joseph is pretending not to understand. What happens is, the text doesn't say that, it's very clear the interpreter leaves the room, and the brothers begin to speak among themselves. They begin to talk and ask themselves, after Joseph says to them, I want you to bring your spies, because I'm spies. They begin to think about, oh my gosh, we're getting the penalty for what we have done. And notice the response, how the brothers are reminiscing. Do you have that there in front of you?
So I have, actually. It's verse 22 has Reuben saying, and this is for, Genesis 42, verse 22, Reuben says, did I not speak to you guys saying, do not sin against the boy? And you would not listen. And therefore, behold, his blood is now required of us.
That verse right before it.
Then they said to one another, we are truly guilty concerning our brother, for we saw the anguish of his soul when he pleaded with us, and we would not hear. Therefore, his distress has come upon us.
This is very important. So we set the stage here. The brothers are talking. Joseph is there, but Joseph is making like he doesn't understand it. He's hearing this. So they're having a conversation. The interpreter is gone. And now they have no reason at all. The reason I'm setting this up so meticulously is that the brothers who are standing there in utter shock, they just came down for food, and this has just turned to an absolute disaster. They know this is a sign from God, and they know that, in fact, they're being punished for something, for a crime they had already committed. Because here, the younger child is the Benjamin. That's all that Jacob had left. Is now being. This is just terrible. And what happens is, but think about what did they blame themselves for? They say this is an omen for what? That we didn't pay any heed to the cry of our brother, to the cry of Joseph, right? That's what they're referring about. But if, in fact, they sold Joseph to the Ishmaelites, if they, in fact, carried out that, they would not have said that. They would have been much more something they would have said, we're being paid back for actually selling him into slavery. That's absent. And the reason it's absent is, in fact, that's not what's happened here in the plain text. I should say there are other commenters who try to work around this, but if you have so many problems, and then Reuven, here we have Reuven, because Reuven is just beside himself, and this is verse 22, and he said, didn't I tell you that we shouldn't kill the boy, and now this is all being avenged. And that's why I'm just going to this conversation here.
It's brilliant, because I totally missed it in the first reading of the New King James, because I see now that I look at verse 28 in chapter 37 that the brothers is in italics and therefore is inserted into the text. It's not actually there. And so really what it says is, then Midianite traders passed by, pulled Joseph up and lifted him out of the pit and sold him to the Ishmaelites for 20 shekels of silver. And then Reuben returned to the pit and Joseph was not there. And what does he say, Jason, in verse 30?
Yeah, so verse 30, I know there are a lot of people that really rely on the text, and they may rely on the text more than they rely on what anyone says about their text. But we have to remember that the pit is in one place, and Reuben is at the pit. Then it says, and he returned to his brothers. So his brothers were not at the pit. And he said, the child is not, meaning is not there. And as for me, where shall I go? So he's delivering that message to the brothers. Now, if the brothers had done those things and sold the boy into slavery, that message and the journey would be impossible to have.
That's a really good point.
Yeah, believe your text, but check your text.
It all makes perfect sense. Yeah.
So what we have is that, you know, plans are being hatched. Hey, let's just take a step back, because I think there is a message here, and that is anger leads to a desire to kill. Then a whole series, as time goes on, Yiskar Daita, which is Aramaic, their anger starts to recede somewhat, and now they're entertaining other possibilities. Reuben has hatched a plan, but what's happened is that time does heal wounds, but remember that time doesn't go on forever. And what's happened is that too much time has gone by. Reuven, you can only imagine, is feeling horrible about this, because everyone is clueless about the whereabouts of Joseph. Everyone is. The only thing is, they all blame themselves specifically for when my brother was crying, we didn't give it the heart. Now, you know, if you notice in the language here, these texts, we're not going to go into a lot, but there's a lot of my brother, the brother, over and over again, and the apathy that they didn't care about their brother's cries, their brother's screams. And the blood screaming from the ground. They didn't pay attention to that. And this certainly harkens back to an earlier part of the book of Genesis, but we have that redundancy of the brother, your brother, your brother. It'll come up a lot. That's in Genesis chapter 4 with Cain and Abel. And the blood is crying out from the ground. Identical language. This symmetry is there for a reason. You see, Cain killed Abel, but no one had ever been murdered before. It's reasonable to conclude that Cain didn't know his brother would die as a result of being killed. And in fact, we see from the punishments, we talked about this, that Cain would endure is the punishment precisely given to someone who kills unintentionally. And here again, we have, and when God approached him, he says, "Am I my brother's keeper?" Which means the apathy. Mm. Now we can go to Genesis 41 and go, the brothers recognize quite right that they had violated that sin of Cain, in that they may have not known exactly what happened, and maybe Cain did not understand the full force of what he was going to do to Abel. No one had been murdered before. But the key is, they recognized that they did not pay attention. They didn't care about their brother. And that was, and the result of that is the destruction. But they themselves didn't sell him. And Reuven, of course, is beside himself. It's impossible to ignore the point also that Reuven lost his firstborn status to Joseph. I mean,
that's a good point.
Reuven, yeah, it means these are good people, and unless you understand what's happening here, that means these are not killers and criminals. Or they would have been Esau. They would not have been able to be the fathers of the Jewish people. So they're not operating like Esav and Lavan and so on. They're enraged about what they consider a righteous indignation. And of course, their hearts are filled with anger and so on. Mm. But what's happening is they didn't hear the screams, the pain, the agony of the brother. And that's the exact indictment that is brought to bear against Cain. And Reuben, he's saving Joseph, even though Reuben basically lost his role as firstborn to Joseph. I think the reason why the hatred is not strong is Reuven didn't lose it to Joseph. That means Joseph had nothing to do with that. It was Reuben's own poor judgment. Joseph wasn't involved in the story there. So Reuven, the firstborn of Leah, is stepping in to save the firstborn of Rachel. It's hard to ignore that.
And yet, even though that was his intention, they obviously sat down after they threw him in the pit. They sat down and they ate, and they obviously wandered off some distance so that evidently the Midianites were able to take him up.
You're not sitting over a pit. Your brother's screaming. You're not sitting. Mm. They believed they were justified. So but we're not going to sit and have a sandwich, a turkey sandwich, next to the pit. So they've gone.
And listen to that. Yeah, so they've wandered off. And they've wandered off with the stock, probably. And they probably thought, at the very least, we're going to teach him a lesson, and we're going to walk away and let him be there by himself and think about, you know, what it's like for us to hear these dreams and so on and so forth, and for him to get around in that tunic. Well, now they've taken the tunic off. And so they took Joseph's tunic, and they killed a kid of the goats and dipped the tunic into the blood, and they sent the tunic of many colors to their father, and they said, "Well, we found this. Do you know whether or not it's your son's tunic or not?" And now it's interesting, isn't it? Because what's happened is they are deceiving their father with the clothes of their younger brother dipped in the blood of a goat. I find that interesting when you consider that it was Jacob who deceived his father with the skin of a goat, wearing it as clothing. Is there a connection here?
Everything, right. Everything is coming around. Everyone is going to pay in every way. Joseph is now going to go Jacob is going to now go for 22 years without seeing his son. We talked about this in the last portion. Mm-hmm. The brothers are very concerned. They need to come up with a story. I mean, why couldn't they just say he's missing? They need to come up with a story, because they didn't have a story to explain for this, Jacob would be saying, go find him, which they believe he's dead, or they believe he's inaccessible, he's gone, he's dead. Reuven is beside himself. But they're also, if you notice, again, it's impossible to ignore the difference between Reuben's response and the other nine. Reuben's response is one of horror, mourning. Their response is completely pragmatic. We've got to come up with a way to explain everything, that we don't have the brother. They actually thought that he's probably gone. They have no clue where he is. But in fact, if Jacob thought that it's just a mystery, Jacob would have pursued this, and they didn't want that either. So they've hatched a plan, but it's really cold in the way they did it. There's no thought at all.
No.
But that's, these are called zvugim in Tanakh. Zvugim means couplets, juxtapositions. So we have Reuben's response, where there's nothing practical about it. It's all just as what we expected. A brother, you know, is wailing over his brother. The other brothers are simply immediately come up with a plan to, and it's of course the taste of the original plan. That means they always plan to with the blood.
That's what it says in verse 20. And so Jacob recognized the tunic, and he said, "It is my son's tunic. A wild beast has devoured him. Without doubt, Joseph is torn to pieces." And Jacob tore his clothes and put sackcloth on his waist and mourned for his son many days. And all his sons, interesting here, Tobiah, all his sons and all his daughters arose to comfort him, but he refused to be comforted. And he said, "For I shall go down to the grave to my son in mourning." Thus his father wept for him. And it ends the chapter by saying, now the Midianites had sold him in Egypt to Potiphar, an officer of Pharaoh and a captain of the guard.
So there's, like you mentioned, a guy who drives a truck in Texas every day. So I just understand the schematic here is you have long-haul truckers and you have local truckers. The Ishmaelites were long haul, because we know the Ishmaelites and their children, the Arabs, these are people who are able, as no other people, to go through the sands of the Sahara, long wilderness, which other people couldn't survive. So they were the long haul truckers. They were able to deliver slaves from one part of this region to another, and they were able to survive everything with their camels or whatever it is. The Edomites, these are people who are negotiators, but they're local. And they're again turning him over to Potiphar, which introduces a whole event which is very, very striking.
Mm. But before we get to that whole event, we have a little intermission, I suppose, or interlude here. Meanwhile, back at the farm, it's chapter 38. How shall we, rather than read this out in the interest of time, do you want to put this in a nutshell, Tobia?
Yeah, so what happens is Judah really is the person who, remember, let's do a process of elimination. This is a numbers point. We're looking for a leader of the nation, the leader of the 12 tribes. All of them are now part of the Jewish people, mm-hmm. but 1, 2, and 3 have been eliminated as leaders. It means that Reuven has been already eliminated because of his bad behavior with Bilhah, mm-hmm. tampering with the beds. We talked about that. Yeah. That would leave number 2, Shimon, but leave number 3, Levi. Shouldn't they then be at the helm? No. They're eliminated as leaders because they had acted so violently with Shechem, wiping out the entire city, which leaves us with the person who will eventually emerge, as we'll see in the end of the book of Genesis, and we'll see why in the chapter passages before us, he's emerging as the leader of the nations. And in fact, he is. He ultimately is granted, we'll see at the end of Genesis in 49, he's granted the greatest blessing specifically of leadership. In fact, Mashiach comes from there. And therefore, because of that responsibility, Judah really has to move on. And he moves away to another area, another region, and mm-hmm. there we see some very interesting things that occur. Judah has a wife. He takes a wife for himself, and he has sons. These sons are wicked. They're sinful. A very interesting thing we'll notice here is that, again, the patriarchs and their family knew the Torah, were aware of the Torah, even before the Torah was given. We have Er v'Onan. These are the two sinful sons of Judah who marry Tamar, and what happens is they're sinful, but Onan, the second son, actually does not want to allow his Levirate wife to become pregnant.
So when you say a Levirate wife, we need to explain that. Just quickly, because verse 6 is striking. It says, Judah took a wife for his firstborn. Her name was Tamar, but Judah's firstborn was wicked in the sight of the Lord, and the Lord killed him. Yeah. I mean, how quick is that? Bang, don't like you, good night.
Yeah.
And Judah said to Onan, now go into your brother's wife, marry her, raise up for her heirs for her brother. Onan knew that the heir would not be his, and so when it came to pass that he went into his brother's wife, but he withdrew. He admitted on the ground lest he should give an heir to his thing which he did displeased the Lord, and therefore, bang, Lord killed him also.
We need Deuteronomy chapter 25, I think it's verse 5 and 6 and 7, to understand Genesis. This is very interesting. We need the Torah to understand what's happening here. Very briefly, mm-hmm. the Torah says in Deuteronomy 25 that if a man is married to a woman and he dies without children, then his next younger brother, the next brother, marries his sister-in-law, which ordinarily would be a forbidden marriage if under any other circumstances. But now the Torah says a commandment that the next brother marries the widow, and the children that he'll have, the child that he has, will then be named after the older son, so that the memory of the older son continues on. The mm-hmm. wickedness of this son is so great that he decides, I do not want to give my brother any memorial, because that's the whole purpose of a Levirate marriage.
He's saying, I want the benefits, but I don't want the responsibility.
He wants the fun, but he doesn't want the, it's not the responsibility. He doesn't want his brother to have a memory. It's really very it's quite wicked. It means he doesn't want his brother's memory to continue. Therefore, he doesn't want Tamar to become pregnant. If she gets pregnant, that child is not named after him, and that child is not regarded as his child, but rather the child of his older brother, Er, and he wasn't interested in doing anything. So once again, we see another brother, who's turned his back on his brother. This is what's going to happen here constantly. It's the same thing happening over and over again. And then we're going to have a stunning event, and that is now Judah becomes a widower. And Tamar, our sages tell us that Tamar, why she's going and dressing with a veil as a prostitute would do to disguise her identity. In the ancient world, even though today in a red light district, a prostitute would not wear a veil, not only not wear a veil, but she would dress in a way that, but in the ancient world, the prostitute would want to cover up her identity. And ultimately, Tamar sensed spiritually that from her would come forth the great the progeny that would lead to everything, would lead ultimately to King David and Mashiach. And we'll see this at the end of the book of Ruth. What's very key here is another point that we've discussed in the past, and that is that nothing is going kosher here. If you notice that everything is coming through the back door. Nothing is coming straightforward. No blessing is delivered in a straightforward manner. Everything that deals with the covenant is around the back door. And to our very day, the state of Israel comes from behind the back door. It's irreligious Zionists that come in. It's a James Balfour, a Christian who's giving the command, who says that the Jews can return. Everything is happening. God is giving Cyrus, saying, don't question my judgment here, but Cyrus is my anointed in 45. Whenever it comes to the covenant being passed down, everything has happened from the back door. Tamar is not interested in, so Judah consorts with Tamar, and she becomes pregnant. And then he doesn't know that it's his daughter-in-law. He condemns her, and she could have embarrassed him in a way that would have been horrible, but she took from him as a payment, as a prostitute's payment, things that were very unique to him, like a signet ring that were identifiable to Judah, the Jew who recognized as his own. And then she's going to disappear from the scene, but she now has this property of Judah that actually was a mashkon. What's the English word for it? When you give a bank, when you take a loan, so you give the bank something to hold on to that you ensure that
security.
A
marker. Okay. Yeah.
Right. So he promises her a kid, an animal, but he doesn't happen to have, people don't walk around with animals in their back pocket. So he gives him his personal belongings that's very identified. She takes it, but that's what she's really after. Because if she would have gotten a kid, she would have gotten a sheep from him. There's nothing about that sheep that's identifiable to Judah.
No, she needs the security. So she needs something that's distinctly his.
Yeah.
And so when it is discovered that she is about 3 months later that she's pregnant, and everyone says, well, how did that happen? And says, your daughter-in-law has been playing the harlot. And Judah says, well, bring her out and let her be burned.
Yeah.
And so it was that she sends him those things and he recognized them as his. And his response is, it's interesting. He says, she has been more righteous than I because I did not give her Shelah, my son, and he never knew her again, is what it says.
Right, because there was a third son. There was a third son who, in fact, was not given. You know, after the first two sons died, they were you to recognize that the first two sons lacked wisdom, which led to their sinful nature. So, part I left out of there's so much to talk about is that when it came to the third son, I mean, son two dies according to Deuteronomy 25. It then would pass on to the third son, who would then become the husband of Tamar to make her pregnant. But Yehuda now realizes, let's wait some time, remain a widow for a while because I want him to become more mature. Quite literally, I want him to grow up. I want him to give him time. So now he's just, he takes upon himself the shame of what's happened here, which very much mirrors the reason why he left the family. Yehuda has one of the great things, that the quality that we'll see in future generations, most spectacular is King David, is ultimately that when King David recognizes his error, you can't help but notice the similarity when Yehuda is confronted with his bad behavior and King David is confronted with his bad behavior. They immediately confess. You know,
they acknowledge that they're shortfall. Yeah,
there's no denial. That means we're going to see what kind of product is David. You know, Yehuda is a man that I think we can all identify with. We can identify with him losing his wife, being lonely, finding a woman, not knowing it's her, and that happening. It's very understandable. What David did is extreme, very extreme, but he's very human. That what is so attractive about Yehuda in every juncture, in every moment, and what is very attractive about David is not that they're these perfect God men in any way. They're human, but what do they do when they're confronted with their sin? They take responsibility. He left the family, and that's why we have this moving away for a brief moment. This is a breakaway scene for a moment. It's very critical in forming the nation of Israel. Yehuda, but the key to take away is Yehuda is confronted. He gets it, and when he gets it, with David it was a parable, with Yehuda it was his personal belongings, he immediately confesses. This is what makes up the kind of quality of leader that we want. It's not someone who says, I am the way, the truth, and the life, no one comes, no, when you see me, you've seen the Father. That's not what we want in a leader. I mean, that's what we're shown here. What is being brought into view is we're looking at people, individuals that just recognize their mistake, that take their time, and are able to confess. And this is going to produce King David.
And so before we get back to the story of Joseph, there's an interesting ending to this particular chapter 38. It says, it came to pass that at the time of giving birth, that behold, twins were in her womb. And so it was when she was giving birth, Tamar, when she was giving birth, that one put out his hand, and the midwife took a scarlet thread and bound it on his hand, saying, this one came out first. And it happened as he drew his hand back in that his brother came out unexpectedly. And she said, how did you break through? This breach be upon you. Therefore, his name was called Perez. Afterwards, his brother came out, who had the scarlet thread on his hand. His name was called Zerah.
Yeah, Zerah. So we have two names here, which is very strange. When a newborn, like today, when a baby comes out, I'm sure for my children it was, I'm sure when your baby comes out, so right away they put a marker, something around the baby so they know which baby it is, the baby isn't confused. Certainly, if you had twins, you certainly would want to mark who was the firstborn here. We have here two children with unique names. One of them is sort of a breach, which means it's punctuated. And the other one is Zerach, which means light. It means this constant light. It's interesting that Peretz, the one who's kind of like comes in and out, he solves the breach, is going to be the progenitor of King David, and he's going to be like the moon in that the moon is not always in the sky like the sun is. The moon comes, and you have a full moon, and then it disappears, and it comes back again. And that's the nature of the Jewish people, to be at a point at the lowest possible state, but don't worry, the light is coming, and it will return back, rather than the constant light, which is not indicative of the nation of Israel. It's indicative of other people. So it's Peretz who's going to produce the Davidic dynasty.
There it is. So chapter 39, it says, now Joseph had been taken down to Egypt, and Potiphar, an official of Pharaoh, captain of the guard, an Egyptian, bought him from the Ishmaelites, now it says, who had taken him down there. And the Lord was with Joseph, and he was a successful man. And it was that in the house of his master, the Egyptian, and his master saw that the Lord was with him. Now, what is that? His master saw that the Lord was with him? Or is that just to say that
it's actually,
everything that he did prospered?
Yeah, that's exactly it. That means this is Egypt. You know, one of the things that's interesting is that the passage emphasized the fact that he was a Mitzri. When we talk about a Mitzri, Egypt represented idolatry, and it represented a land that produced fantastic agriculture but didn't have to depend on rain. So therefore, you see here the passage in verse 2, the emphasis is on he's an Egyptian, which means how does he judge if someone is successful, if God is with him? It's if he produces, if he's bringing in the goods, if he's bringing in the money. That's the way Egyptians, in Yiddish it's called shatztap. That's how they assessed that God is with you. And in fact, you'll see that everything in his house, no matter what, this is very reminiscent of Jacob with the spotted sheep. No matter what Jacob did, it just, and this is also very reminiscent of the Jew. You know, the Jew, he's thrown out of one country, goes to another country, and the Jew is successful. If you go to Central America, places like, Belize and so on, Costa Rica, you have people who are poor, and then you have this few thousand Jews in Panama, a few thousand Jews, and they're like the wealthiest people in the country, that no matter where they go, they have this blessing with them, and people will look at this, of the ability of the Jewish people to acquire wealth, and there's just, no matter if they go into the industry of film, banking, music, whatever they're doing, people are recognized, there's something unique about the Jewish people. As such, this Mitzri, he's going to trust Joseph in everything except for one thing. And that is, he won't trust him with his bread, the text says. And then there are two interpretations of what the bread means. But the simple explanation is that people like these were very high officials. They didn't just eat food that you handed them. They had a taster. It means it was food. Someone had to take that much trust for his own personal health. Or one might say he didn't trust him with his wife, and that would be his bread. That's another interpretation. But the key is this is so irregular. You see, it's hard for us as 21st century people to, in the ancient world, a slave did not work in the house, wasn't in the home. They were out in the field and they lived in cabins. I remember being in the Bahamas, and they could see the little stone buildings, tiny little buildings that slaves lived in. They never would enter the home. I mean, in the ancient world, slaves did not enter the home. They were out in the field. They lived in miserable conditions. Oh no, he wanted Joseph to oversee everything, because whatever Joseph touched turned to gold. And we're going to see that even as he, right now, where one would think, you know, nothing could turn to gold. I mean, imagine being in an Egyptian prison. No, he's rises to the, but we haven't gotten to there yet. So
essentially he's placed second in charge, I suppose, as we're going to see a little later on again, but it does say that the master saw that the Lord was with, that the Lord was with him. And I suppose that's not an unfamiliar phrase, is it, Jason?
Yeah. No, it's not. And there's, I'm struggling to find the passages, but I'm pretty sure it turns up at least twice in his lineage. So, and I think it's going to be Isaac and Jacob, but they're both greeted with, I see the Lord is with you. I mean, we have the bit where Laban talks about how well Jacob deals with that. And I think it might even be the servant of Abraham who, when he meets Laban,
and
first time he says, I can see that the Lord is with you. And I think it's a sign of prosperity and wealth, and they can see that they've been blessed, maybe is a good way of saying that happens. I love at the end of verse 6, before we move on to 7, and Joseph was of beautiful form and fair to look upon, and I have to think he gets that from his mother.
That's a good point.
I should say that our sages point to that passage that Jason just talked about. By he, Yosef, Yofe Soar, he was very good looking, and the Fe Mare, and he was just so handsome, it was so striking, it was just beautiful to look at. That's what the text, I mean, you have, you know, sometimes you have, I don't know how about you, but if you ever walk into like a Macy's store and you see like they have these models and pictures and you go, wow. And like one of us ordinary guys go, you feel like, you know, going, wow, look
speak
at that
for yourself,
guy.
Toby.
He's got a six pack. Okay. Well, I work out in the gym every day, so I'm different than everybody else. But you go, whoa, I'm really in a lot of trouble. But Joseph, the sense is also paying a little bit too much attention to the way he looks. He's obviously, Hashem blessed him with very good looks. But Yosef is, a sage asked the question, his father, he knows his father thinks he's dead, and you're paying that much attention to how you look. You're curling your hair, you're making yourself look attractive, while your father is in absolute agony, and you have to know that. So there is, our sages look at that as, what's going to get Joseph in trouble is, in fact, what are you doing paying that much attention to the good genes that you've already given?
Although, I have to jump in and say that in a kind of real world scenario, and if you're in Egypt, maybe that's exactly what you should do. I mean, you don't turn up to a job interview in muddy shoes, dirty jeans, and a torn t-shirt. If you're landed in the middle of a place which puts so much stead in how you look and the kind of, the beauty of things and the shine and the glory and the finish of everybody and everything, maybe the thing you should do is make yourself look the best you can.
Let's push that. Jason, let's go with that avenue. Let's say that Joseph, being very attractive, would in fact advance his career and act as a way to protect him from negative elements. That would then further the case, because that means that Joseph is, as we'll see in a moment, is going to be relying on all of devices to get himself out of this very bad predicament, and a worse predicament very soon. If he was relying on his good looks to sustain him rather than God. So again, this might hint at something, the reason why Joseph would get in trouble for his good looks. The reason I'm focusing on this, the reason the sages are focusing on this is, as John pointed out, as you pointed out, everything is coming back to everybody. It's his good looks ultimately that get him in trouble, that get him thrown into prison. So,
listen, by the way, maybe even because he's a striking young man, maybe even it's another source for his brothers to be envious of him.
Mm-hmm.
Perhaps. The text doesn't say as much, but we can speculate. But in any case, it does get him into trouble because the wife of Potiphar wants to sleep with him. Yeah. There he is, he's managing the affairs of the household. Yeah, Potiphar's away, and she wants to sleep with him, and he refuses to do it. In fact, he says, "How can I do this great wickedness and sin against God?" is what he says to her.
That's at the end. It's very interesting that, you remember, she's an Egyptian woman, and sinning against God is not going to really persuade her. See, Joseph is in a really bad predicament. One little point, I can't ignore this. Just the beginning of verse 8, it says there, and the vayimoein, which means he refused. I don't know if you have a Hebrew Bible in front of you, Tanakh. There is I never did this, and I don't think I'll ever do this again in our shows, but there is a musical note above that word, which is called the chain. It's called the shalshelas. It only appears four times in the entire Torah. And it goes by the way it would be read in the Torah is vayimoein, and over again, which means he is really struggling. She's very attractive. She's literally walking around the negligee. Joseph has not been with a woman he's lonely. He's in a fantastic position. He's a fantastic position if you want to sleep. He's got it all. Imagine if he would sleep with her. If he slept with her, boy, he'd have everything. In fact, she's going to bribe him. She's walking around half undressed. She's doing everything to seduce him. And this is a struggle for him. It's this word, if you're in a synagogue, vayimoein, is stretched out. And it's one of only four places, and in each of the four junctures where this trup is used, it's a long decision that unfolds. So anyway, so I just wanted to point that out. Something so rare that happens here. But look at what he says to her. He can't say to her, the God is, I will sin before God. He throws that in at the end.
at the end, but he says, look, my master does not know what is with me in the house, and he has committed all that he has to my hand.
Right.
There is no one greater in his house than I,
right.
Nor has he kept anything back from me, but you are his wife. How can I do this great wickedness and sin against God? This is what he says.
So that's the thing. When you're talking to an Egyptian, I think this goes to Jason's point. When you're talking to an Egyptian, you have to talk like an Egyptian, walk like an Egyptian. Well, Joseph is using her standards that, you know, how can I was given a trust. How can I break that? Sinning against God, well, that's at the very end. That's going to come in all of the end. But the real argument that he's in a bad situation. Actually, the situation is going to get worse immediately. He's in a really bad situation, and we see exactly what Joseph is terrified of. And the throwing in the God part, that's at the very end of that, not at the beginning. Because that would mean
She's clearly insulted. You know, how dare you deny me? You deny me? I am it. You're turning me down? You don't turn me down. This is the kind of attitude that I pick up from her in the text, and so much so that she really does attempt to rape him, right?
Yeah, I mean, well, she is lusting. Look at her, the words that are used. If we go back here, she raised her eyes. If we can sort of walk this back a little bit, the text is by Batisa. This is verse 7. Batisa Ashes Adonov S. Aneho El Yosef, and the wife of Joseph's master raised her eyes towards Joseph, okay, and she said, sleep with me. This is very, you know, this is very raw. This is raw lust. She wanted to sleep with him. I don't necessarily generally do this, but our sages tell us that she envisioned that from her and a combination of her and Joseph, meaning that kind of relationship, would produce a great nation. And in fact, Joseph would ultimately marry her daughter. That was her mistake. But anyways, I don't want to get into that because that's not in the plain text. And I just want to move
ahead. Well, in the text, what happens is that she does attempt to pull him to the bed, so to speak, and he sheds his clothes and runs away. That's all that he can do to get out of the situation. And she's so, what's the word? She's so, I don't know.
I can think of the word, but I can't put it in the show.
Okay, we'll leave it to the listeners to fill in the blanks there. But
she's also in a bad position. She's in a bad position because now whoever makes it to Potiphar first with the story, they each have now a story. Obviously, right now, all this kind of her walking around in her negligee or whatever she isn't wearing, that hasn't worked. That's gone on for a long time. But now he ran with his keep my clothes and he runs out. At this point, she's got to make a scene first. She's got to be the first person to make the claim because if Joseph...
She has to cover her
faces, yeah. And she has in her hands... This is where the Torah is sort of guiding our eyes. She's looking at Joseph's clothing and left behind, and she's going, wow, I have the evidence in my hands now to protect it, that my story will hold up. Here is Joseph's clothing that he took off in attempting to rape me. Instead of Joseph, so she has the physical evidence, the smoking gun. That's what we're looking at. So that's what the Torah is pointing her eyes. The garment is left, and then she calls out, and so on. And that's what's going to happen here.
And so she lies. That she says, the Hebrew servant whom you brought to us came into me and mocked me, and so it happened that I lifted my voice and I cried out, and he left his garment, and he fled outside. And so the master of the house bought the lie. At least he had to appear that he bought the lie. In any case, Joseph's master took him and put him into a prison. That's the first time we hear about a prison in the Torah.
Oh, yeah. And also, one other point. I can't help. Do you notice she said, I'm transposing here, the Jew that you brought into our house turned out trying to rape me. That means the Egyptians coming out and saying, you don't bring... They were hated in Egypt because Egypt was everything that the Hebrews weren't. You know? So therefore, you notice she... what is the Jew, this Hebrew man, what did you do? Well, what does him being a Hebrew man have to do with any of that? That's not relevant. No. What did you do, bring a Jew into our homes?
So into our house.
That's dropped in there.
But it says the Lord was with Joseph and showed him mercy and gave him favor in the sight of the keeper of the prison, and the keeper of the prison committed to Joseph's hand all the prisoners. And once again, he becomes the 2IC, right?
Yeah, he's right. He's right again. People recognize in Joseph, they see in him features, qualities, but he always remains faithful to God. In Jewish tradition, as King David, these are two zavut. They're very similar, and that is, no matter how, I mean, just stop for a moment. Joseph has been betrayed how many times? Please, let's not lose sight of the events here. Joseph has been betrayed over and over again. He had good reason to walk away from God, just as Jacob. Like, Jacob, the whole portion began with Jacob finally could settle down. That's how it begins. Vayeshev, Jacob settled down. Well, everything but settling down happened. Everything goes bad. Just like when Abraham comes into the land, bang, is a famine. So what's happening is actually, you look at the newspapers, you know, every day, it's about Israel, about another attack. And they're like, when does this stop? When does Hamas leave us alone? Another rocket, another thing. So Joseph is the quintessential tzaddik in that it's called Yosef HaTzaddik, because Joseph is the person who, despite every reason for being completely depressed and to give up on God, he ultimately is that individual who could say, no, I trust in Hashem. He's going to be judged on a very high level as a result, but he doesn't walk away from God. And David also is a person who won't walk away from God, despite the fact that his son wanted to kill him, betrayed on every level, his father-in-law, his wife treated him badly in every way, but they remained faithful to God at every juncture, no matter how bad things got.
So what you're saying is that Joseph, on this level, represents a parallel of the Jewish people. This is what you're saying, right?
The ideal, this is what we should strive to do. And this is what David did. And that's why we talked about this many times. David had every reason to be sad and every reason to say, God, I'm out of here. Betrayal. And David said, no, you know, the Lord is my shepherd. What is it about? Even though I walk in the valley of death, you know, you will. I mean, Joseph is not giving up on God, never abandons his identity. And we're going to see in a moment, in the depths of everything, he's going to announce that he's a Jew. He obviously, Potiphar's wife knew that he was a Jew. He's not hiding his identity. He's saying, how did she know? Look, the Hebrew man you brought us, she knew it. Everybody knows it. He's a proud Jew. He's not going to hide it. There are people who are going to hide it. Maybe just, you know, it's an interesting thing that Joseph is identifying himself as a Jew. The brothers had assessed him incorrectly. And in fact, he identifies as a Jew constantly. And Joseph will be therefore rewarded to be buried in the land of Israel. Moses, who actually, when he's asked with this scene where he encounters the daughters of Moab, the daughters of the Midianites, he identifies as an Egyptian, and in fact is never buried in the land of Israel. So Joseph has a merit here as identifying as a Jew. We're going to see that come up again.
So that's fascinating. And just to jump off the topic a little, it's interesting that you should, you know, say that Joseph is parallel to the Jewish people as a whole. Coming from the Christian tradition, Jason, you must be familiar with the parallels of Joseph and Jesus that is often made in the church. What are some of the things that come to your mind?
Oh, well, that's actually something that's on my mind when I was reading this through. You are told that he was kind of a shadow of the Jesus character,
and
you
have these in typology, yeah.
He's sold into a pit for a certain amount of silver by a person with a certain name, and then he was taken off into slavery in the story, but we know that he was considered to be dead, so they turn that into a whole resurrection thing. And then you end up with this guy who is a king, and he's his brothers, the Jewish people, come before him, but they don't recognize him as their king until he reveals himself. There are a whole lot of parallels, but as I was reading through the Torah portion and thinking about those parallels, I was kind of ticking them off. But then it's difficult, actually, when you look at any of those individual claims, to give them any flesh.
So you're aware of these parallels?
Yeah, right? I heard of it before. Yeah. So there's two layers here. one layer is we pause, you know, people often say Jesus never lived, did live, didn't live. I think it's easy to come up with a construction of what likely did occur in the first century. And that is that the people, there was many thousands of itinerant preachers at the time and so on. People may have thought of Jesus as being the Messiah in a traditional sense. We don't know this. I'm speculating, but it certainly could be. And then once he died, so people would have said, okay, this would have been a disconfirmation. That means what I thought was a mistake. But there's some people who couldn't let go of it and said, no, well, you know what? Jesus is the Messiah, and he was crucified. So therefore, the Messiah is to be crucified and die. And he couldn't be dying for himself because he didn't sin at all. So he must have been dying for somebody else. But then they're left. So that's obviously. So what they're saying is that Jesus is the Messiah. The Messiah is crucified. Therefore, the Messiah has to be crucified. The problem they have then is we don't have any passages to support this. What the church will then do is go back into the church leaders will go back into the Jewish scriptures and scour it for anybody suffering, for anybody getting in trouble, anyone who's betrayed, and then place that onto Jesus and say that this is a fulfillment of what Jesus did. So we have Hosea 11:1, out of Egypt I call my son. Matthew will misappropriate that. And so there's two levels. So one level is we very clearly see here why Christians feel compelled to use Joseph as a picture of Jesus. The reason is they don't have graphic text. If there was an Isaiah chapter 67 that in fact said that God will have a son and his son will be crucified and he will rise on the third day, and if you believe in him, you'll be saved, they wouldn't be doing this. That means the reason, what I'd like to do for the listeners is, instead of just staying where people normally stay, is they're misappropriating. They're misappropriating and using this, or using Hosea 11:1, or using Isaiah 3, because they didn't have anything. And if there were graphic texts, we wouldn't need this. When you ask a Jew, why do you keep Shabbos to eat kosher? We don't have to engage in this kind of stuff. We just go to Leviticus 11 and Exodus 31. We don't need to do this kind of theological circus to engage in. This also, I think, tells us about the hatred between Esav and Jacob, between the Jews and the church, in that the church is going to say that God's only begotten son is Jesus. The Jewish people are going to point to Exodus 4, Hosea 11. No, God's son is Israel. The church is going to say that the Jews killed Jesus and therefore are culpable of committing the unspeakable act of deicide. The Jews are going to say, church, no, you have killed us, and we have suffered as a result of your bad behavior, Isaiah 53. That's really the war. The war is who is God's son, and who is to blame for the other person's suffering. That's why I think Jews are it's so important to Jews that Christians acknowledge the horrors of the Holocaust. I think there's something deeper here. And those are saying, acknowledge that we are God's son, and you Christians killed God's son, namely Israel. And the church is going, no, Jesus is God's son, and you Jews killed Jesus. That's what's really happening here. Which texts are clear and support? Well, that's obvious. And why would they have, when missionaries use midrashim texts, rabbinic texts, why? They don't believe in it. The reason is they don't have graphic texts that describe it. So, yes, they're using this, and many others, Muslims use all kinds of texts, but the key is they don't have it, and there's something really deep going on.
They don't have something concrete, and so right, they have to cut the text.
That's why they have to. I don't envy them. Someone I was speaking to, a Jew who was in the church, who repented and said, you know, when I went to my messianic leaders, they couldn't have an answer, they had to go into somersaults, and I said to the guy, I don't think he expected this, I said to him, you know, I'll tell you the truth, if I was a messianic leader, I feel bad for him. Not really, but I'm saying you're in a really bad predicament if you've got to defend Christianity. You've got to come up with this kind of somersault, right? Because I mean, I wouldn't want to defend that. People say, "Oh, you did great in a debate." That's not a big deal to defend the truth. But James Bond. You've seen the James Bond movies. He's really slick. He's really smart, and he's able to do things. And we'd all get into a lot of trouble. He's able to line his get out of every problem. Through that's tough to do, to be able to get, you know, to lie. That's you have true. To be smart, you know. You don't have to be that smart to tell the truth.
But you need an endless supply of shadows and types right. in order to at least bluff your way out of a question exactly. with an onslaught of so-called connections. And that's certainly what we see in the church when it comes to the story of Joseph. But we have to move on. The last chapter that we're dealing with here is Joseph in the prison, and we have the butcher, the baker, and the candlestick. Well, we don't. We have the butler and the baker. And essentially, I think this we're talking about the cup holder of Pharaoh and the baker. Now, Jason, I reckon it is my theory, and this is not in the text, but I reckon Pharaoh had a bout of food poisoning and he's not too sure who to take it out on. What do you reckon?
You know, that's a very fair assumption. The guy, the Egyptian cup holder, is actually the scribe of the sideboard. I'm not making that up.
Really?
So, yeah. So I think they were both overseers. They would have been the two people who maybe were responsible for... They're the last mouths that food would have touched before it got to Pharaoh. Mm. Yeah.
Mm. Yeah. In Jewish tradition, this is what happened. I mean, why does the butler, he's restored, really, to his exact place? In fact, Pharaoh will drink directly from his hand without even a taster. Why does Pharaoh trust him so easily? And why doesn't he trust... Why is the baker doomed? Tom will tell us very clearly what happened here, and that is the error of the butler was that a fly fell into the wine, and Pharaoh was that's what got him thrown in prison. Whereas the baker, actually a pebble wound up in his bread.
That's not good.
Oh, right. That's not good, right. But there's a very big difference between the two, and that is a person could do everything right. You could be serving wine, do everything right, and a fly just flies in. Doesn't mean you put the fly in there. Doesn't mean you were reckless. Just flies all over there, aren't they? I'd imagine they have screen doors.
Yeah.
And more than that, if, let's say, Pharaoh would have consumed the wine with a fly in it, he wouldn't have died. It wouldn't have harmed him. On the other hand, with the pebble inside the baker's, inside the bread, first is that means that the pebble had to already been there. The fly could have jumped in at the last second as Pharaoh was bringing it to his mouth, right? Didn't mean that the butler was irresponsible. But with the baker, as you said, he would have choked on it. That means the baker, that means the pebble had to be in the dough originally. That means that bad judgment is far worse in the eyes of...
The management of the kitchen was obviously lacking for a pebble to end up in the dough. And the last thing you want to bite into when you're chewing your bread is to crunch your teeth on a pebble. And if that's the case, then I can certainly understand Pharaoh sending them off.
You could die from that,
That's serious stuff. And so they have a dream, and there's no one to interpret the dream. And Joseph says, look, the interpretations belong to God. Tell me the dream. And so they told him the dream, and Joseph interprets the dream, and he says to the cupbearer, you're going to be restored. He says to the baker, you're going to get killed. But he says to the guy who's going to be restored in verse 14, remember me when it is well with you, and please show kindness to me. Make mention of me to Pharaoh and get me out of this house. For indeed, I was stolen away from the land of the Hebrews, and I have done nothing here that I should be put into the dungeon.
Right, right. So again, Joseph here, and going back in verse 15, declares I'm a Jew. He's not ashamed to say that he's a Jew.
Yep.
In Egypt, this is not, you know, this is not like being in Australia, I'm a Jew. This is in Egypt, or this is in Lebanon, I'm a Jew. Okay, so he's willing to say that. And again, our sages tell us this is why his merit, that his bones will be buried in the land of Israel, in Shechem. What's happened here is, but there is, Joseph is held on the highest standard in that our sages see what's occurred here in that, if you notice, if I find kindness, you know, in your eyes, it's the same kind of language that Jacob was using to, will I get God's kindness? But he kind of put too much faith in the butler. And therefore, this is on the 10th year. Joseph, because he's saying this to the two, he's going to spend another 2 years in prison because he's forgotten Joseph, because he is essentially has looked right. I mean, he's initially supposed to be in for 10 years. He ultimately is in there for 2 years. He's forgotten about. And of course, this is the story of the Jew who has received promises from the American American Congress that Jerusalem mm-hmm. cannot be divided. It's actually a pass, but now Congress has apparently forgot its promise to Israel. Congress promised that American Congress, I'm talking about Obama, you know, we're talking about American Democrats, have promised that we are going to ensure that Iran will not be able to achieve nuclear mm-hmm. weapons, and nothing has been taken off the table. We've all heard that kind of lingo. Nothing is, no mm-hmm. option has been removed from the table, thereby saying we will, we have your back, Israel. But in fact, the end of the story, what's happening before Rise today in the news is that, in fact, the cupbearer forgot Joseph.
But forgot Joseph. He was on the third day, he was restored on Pharaoh's birthday, and the butler...
The only birthday in the Torah, by the way, the only birthday in the Torah.
Really? That's fascinating. And he said, but he hanged the chief baker as Joseph had interpreted to them, and our Torah portion ends with this verse. Mm. And Tobia, this verse, let me just read it. It says, yet the chief butler did not remember Joseph, but forgot him. It, for me, it reminds me of Jonathan Pollard. Mm. He comes to mind.
Yeah. I mean, Jonathan, what a tragedy, because the news stories are coming out every single. I see Jonathan Pollard as a little bit more nefarious, meaning Jonathan Pollard is very deliberate. I don't think anyone forgot Jonathan Pollard in the Obama administration. I think the big
one. He's overlooked and overlooked and overlooked.
I want to play devil's advocate. Is Reuters and Associated Press, the media, just overlooking the truth, or do they know the truth and they're specifically deliberately twisting it? I think the media clearly, when a terrorist uses his car and mows into a group of people waiting for a train and kills a 3-month-old boy, and then a policeman kills the terrorist in Jerusalem, which just occurred, and the terrorist is shot and killed. And Associated Press, the headline on CNN is, Israeli policeman kills Arab in Jerusalem. That's the headline. I don't think these people in the Associated Press are that stupid. I think they want to deliberately poison the minds of their readers to say that they don't mention a context. I don't think they forgot it. I think they very quite deliberately are trying to strip a context. But I think this goes to more the friends. That means this is really the Democrats in America who have forgotten their friend Israel. They really have forgotten the promises that they made. I think that, you know, this is the Barbara Boxer who admonished Bibi Netanyahu about 8 months ago, saying that you shouldn't be criticizing the President of the United States, but forgot the very votes that she herself stood on, that Obama is... I think that this is... We forgot about the Jew, forgot about the kindliness. Look at Britain that owes, as certainly as James Balfour believed, the owed a great deal of success in World War One to the chemist Ezra Weizmann, who was the first president of the State of Israel. But how long did it take from James Balfour's proclamation in the early 1920s till we get to 1947 and it comes to the vote in November on the partition of Palestine, and England wasn't there. They abstained from the vote. They forgot about the promises they had made. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Well, that is it. That concludes our Torah portion. Next week, we are in Michetz, and that is Genesis chapter 41, verse 1 to 44, verse 17. Jason, any final thoughts?
No.
I'll give you a final thought. I'm going to read your book again before I go to bed.
You do. It won't take long.
I will. It's going to happen. Yeah. Don't forget to purchase it on Amazon, people. And while you're there, go and also find... Or from his website, outreachjudaism.org, you can get a copy there. Let's Get Biblical. Why doesn't Judaism accept the Christian Messiah? Volumes 1 and 2. Get both volumes. They are well worth it, and I highly recommend them. Thank you, gentlemen, for coming back on Torah Pearls. And until next week, dear listeners, be blessed and be set apart by the truth of our Father's Word. Shalom.